This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And my name is Gigi Foster. Hello.
Each week at this time, we argue a bit, chew the fat, and try to solve an economic problem. Today, Gigi, I've got a confession to make. Until a few years ago, this shames me, I didn't think this was a problem. I had been indoctrinated at university, and I believed ever since that inequality didn't matter much. If a few billionaires got most of the wealth, so long as everyone else was getting richer, it didn't matter. So today, why inequality matters, why it matters more than it did, how big it is, and why most of us don't have a clue about it, and also why it's growing. Could it be corruption? Gigi, first that confession. Was I dumb, blinded or inculcated at university, unable to resist? What happened to me?
Well, I think what you describe is pretty typical of economics education in the recent past. We generally have been taught that economics concerns itself with getting the biggest pie for society and that carving up that pie is a kind of second order issue that will happen after production with political involvement.
That's exactly what
they told me. Exactly. So you don't have to worry about it, right?
It's all over there. When I was a child, I was terribly concerned about inequality. I remember telling my dad I thought everyone should be paid the same according to need until I attended my first economics lecture.
Look, yep.
Here's an illustration, I think, of what might have happened to me. It's an extract from a video, My Friend Sarah, created by Mark Maranta and Tara Strong. Tell me if you think it describes what happened to me.
We've always gotten along great until last semester. She was the president of our school's progressive FDR club.
But then she started taking some economics class. It started with a few free market outbursts here and there, but then she got annoying.
She kept ranting about supply and demand. We'd be eating dinner and all of a sudden she'd be drawing these graphs on our napkin.
She also kept bringing up some study. I think it was called the Economic Freedom of the World Index or something. It showed how the countries with less government regulation tend to be more prosperous. Ugh. Yeah, right.
Why, Gigi? Why was, and that was how it was for me.
Yep.
And probably for you, what on earth happened to make economics? Surely it can't have always been like that.
No, not at all. I mean, a lot of the most famous economic thinkers in the history of the discipline have been greatly concerned with distribution. Karl Marx is a perfect example. One of the most popular economic thinkers amongst my first year undergraduates, he was concerned about the division of resources between capitalists and laborers, and in fact predicted the collapse of the entire capitalist system because of those tensions around distribution.
Have those who don't.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it really was only starting in about the 70s that this issue of, wait a minute, are we really doing enough for people on the lower end of society? Is the redistributional arm of government operating as efficiently or as much as
indeed,
it should be?
Was that inevitable? That might have been the question, certainly by the 80s when inequality started increasing. People might have been wondering, is this some, and this is very relevant now as we move to new technologies, will the next industrial revolution cost people jobs, or will, as before, jobs and high incomes be created? Was it inevitable? I suppose this is, in fact, one of the big questions today, that this would happen. And does it mean it'll happen this time?
Well, I mean, if you look at all the developed nations around the world today, every single one of them has massive institutionalized protections in place now for workers. So, you know, maximum hours per day, worker safety requirements that must be upheld, you know, all sorts of checks and balances to ensure that the workers are in a reasonably, you know, humane state of work, unlike back in the early 1800s when there was, you know, hardly such a rule in place. Countries that have developed have worked these things out, increasingly been able to afford what I might call the luxury good, you know, of taking care of the lower classes.
And you're giving me the impression you think that the better angels of people who are well off will continue to ensure through regulations, parliament and so on, that the people who aren't well off are at least not exploited further.
Oh, I would not say anything about angels. No. I mean, this is an economic phenomenon from my perspective. It just gets to the point that there is enough political pressure and enough money available to satisfy that political pressure that, you know, societies start to then distribute a bit more to the lower edges of society.
We're far less equal than we were. The head of BHP, this is a study by Andrew Lee, the politician, now gets paid 200 times the average wage. Now, only back at the start of the 1980s, when inequality started taking off, the head of BHP got 6 or 7 times the average wage. Now, does that matter? You know, maybe what they taught me in economics is right. Maybe it doesn't matter because even people on the average wage are getting slightly better off.
Yeah, no, this is true. But actually, there has been some recent study of this by economists, including our Nobel laureate, Joe Stiglitz. And his research has been backed by a recent report from the IMF saying that actually, when you look across countries, there is lower growth in those countries where inequality is greater. So inequality itself, per se, is a drag on economic growth. And that's something we weren't taught.
Well, what we were taught was that you need inequality.
Of course.
Because to do that, that gives people an incentive to work harder. It means that those people who are do well save money and invest it in companies which buy machines and so on.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, if you don't have any inequality at all, you've essentially got a communist system of, you know, to each according to his need, and that destroys incentives for work. And this is one reason why the Soviet Union collapsed.
I'll tell you what, research from Harvard Business School, back at the start of this decade, they asked Australians what they thought. The survey found that across all incomes, Australians generally believed the richest 20% had 40% of the wealth. Mm-hmm. Now, they thought that was too high. They prefer the richest 20% to have around 24% of the wealth, which isn't really mathematically particularly possible. It wouldn't be the richest. However, the truth at the time, and it might have got worse, is that the richest 20% in Australia had 60% of the wealth.
Yep, that's more like
that
it.
We seem to be oblivious. You know how everyone thinks they're middle class? There's a survey asking households on more than $200,000, which is top 10% of households, to describe themselves. And two-thirds said they were middle class. Middle class? They weren't middle class. So what is it that keeps us from knowing the truth?
Well, if you think about it, everybody, generally speaking, associates with people in a similar income bracket. So take your example of, you know, people who make a lot of money. Surgeons, for example, they earn an average wage of over, you know, $340,000 per year, according to the tax office. These people are going to associate with other people who are also in a very high income bracket. Similarly, hairdressers who earn an average of about $25,000 a year, many of them are part-time, they also hang around with people who are earning roughly similar incomes, right? And nobody wants to think of himself or herself as a loser. So they're not going to want to be exposed to or to accept information coming in about how other people are doing better than they are. So,
or a winner.
They want to win. Oh, yeah.
Well, no, they don't want to think of it. For ABC program a while ago, I tried to find rich people and poor people and middle class people. I could not find someone who identified themselves as rich. Mm. And the way I did it was to ring up people who, you know, I'd found out were rich and say, I want to talk to some middle class people about right?
Yeah.
So they do not think it.
Sure, but I mean, at heart, in our heart of hearts, we all do want to win. I think it's just the norms of the nation state saying that you're not supposed to be too far out in front of everybody else that keeps us feeling a little guilty when we do actually win.
I think it's getting worse, and this is a Productivity Commission study that they reported. High-income earners increasingly marry each other. This didn't used to be the case as much. At the moment, it's two-thirds of high-income earners marry other high-income earners. And just a decade ago, it was 50%. So we seem to be getting a situation where, if you like, even the traditional way, this goes back to our gender program perhaps, the traditional way for a woman to increase status, wealth in society, was to marry up. Perhaps because we've got so many women graduating from university, that's no longer really an option. The high-income men are getting the high-income women. And they live in different suburbs.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. This issue of, you know, people associate with those who are in a similar income bracket, that partly hides from us what our real position in society is and how big a problem inequality actually is.
Why do we have this growing inequality? I ask that because you've done a study, one of the key pieces of research in this area. Mm. You did it with Paul Freitas, who we had on the program earlier,
yep.
About the Business Review Rich List. You've tried to work out how Australians get rich in the top 200.
Yeah. So,
what did you find?
Well, so the traditional economic explanation for increasing inequality is that it's about skill-biased technological change, which is a mouthful, but basically it means people with the skills to work together with machines should benefit in terms of their labor productivity and ultimately their wages when we have innovations and new machines.
This is why in the US we have the innovators who get rich.
That's the idea. Bill Gates may get rich because he combines his skill with technology that is rapidly increasing in terms of its, you know, efficiency, right?
Who gets rich here?
Well, that's the question. So we queried that exact question using Australian data on who are the richest amongst us and just asked. So the BRW Rich List publishes a list of the, you know, top 100 or 200 richest people in Australia every year. So we wanted to see whether the industries where those people had made their money were industries that featured a lot of technical change that could be combined with high skill and then deliver those sorts of additional returns, additional wages and, you know, money for people who had those skills, and therefore in some sense that it was economically justifiable that those people had gotten so rich. So we did this. It was a very, very simple study, one of the simplest studies I've ever done. And essentially we found that the richest Australians were not in healthcare or IT or entertainment or other industries where you might expect a lot of technological change has happened recently and, you know, the skill could combine with it, but rather the richest Australians are in industries like property, natural resources, managing investments, where there hasn't been much technological change, and it looks more like there's something political going on rather than this skill-biased technological change story.
Let's bring in an expert who sees, well, let's call it corruption all around us, which is if you're in the real estate industry, you can benefit from government decisions to change the zoning of land and so on. That could be why many of us can't recognise it. Because we're not party to those negotiations. You're listening to The Economists on RN with Dr. Gigi Foster and me, Peter Martin. Why are the rich getting richer and the poor much worse off relative to the rich than they realise?
Joining us in our Brisbane studio is Dr. Cameron Murray, senior economist at the Australia Institute and co-author with Paul Freitas of Game of Mates, How Favours Bleed the Nation. Good afternoon, Cameron.
Thanks for having me, Gigi. Peter.
You've been listening in. Where is this political corruption that we're claiming many of us can't see?
I think a lot of people are starting to see it, but it's really all around us. And I wouldn't use the term corruption specifically. Corruption really implies that we have a set of rules and someone's stepping outside those rules in order to favour their mates or something like that.
Mm.
What's really happening is we don't really have very good rules, and when politicians or bureaucrats or business leaders are in those positions of power, they're manipulating the rules to their own advantage to favour their mates and entrench that class, those networks of interest, to really siphon off the income flows of the economy towards themselves rather than sharing them as widely as possible.
Or to people like them. What's an example?
What's a good example? Well, the land rezoning is a classic one. Okay, that's just a freebie. The stroke of a pen from a government agency can take someone's plot of land, turn it from being worth $1 million to $10 million the next day. Okay, and typically what happens with those decisions, and I've done a large research study on this, looking at a number of rezoning decisions, 12,000 landowners and a network of relationships between politicians, lobbyists, industry groups, you know, the previous employers of staff at the department that rezoned them, all those sorts of things,
right.
250,000 relationships. And what you find is that those who are really well connected, who rotate in and out of government jobs, get their land rezoned. And in that study, that favour, a once-off, was worth $710 million. So the next day, those landowners who are well connected could turn around and sell their sites for $710 million more than what they were worth the previous day, just because they'd worked those relationships to get those economic rents for free.
And mining, of course, also would be.
Mining's another
classic one. It's the same
sort
of thing. The government can say, yes, you're allowed to mine here. Oh, I just happen to own this property here.
Yeah, that's it's another classic case. I mean, it's an industry, like Gigi said, with no real innovation in technology. It's really just, I want mine approved instead of someone else's. I want a discount on royalties, things like that. And miners spend a lot of money and waste a lot of resources trying to lobby for those favours. And
I've got to ask you, is this different? Are we different from, say, the US or the UK, the countries we compare ourselves to?
No, that's I was listening to your talk before and I was thinking, yeah, but this is what always happens everywhere in human history.
Mm.
In times of stability, people aren't busy fighting the enemy. What they're doing is fighting for themselves and their mates.
Am I wrong to characterise Microsoft Bill Gates as someone who's actually done something rather than collected favours?
The counterfactual is that you have shorter-term property rights on those intellectual property, and in compared to that world, a lot of his money is basically economic rent. It's a freebie because he's got these legal protections for something he did decades ago that have been perpetuated. So, I mean, we can't easily differentiate, oh, he did that because he earned it, or, you know, what he's earned is because of these protections of his intellectual property rights.
So to a certain extent, though, Cameron, I mean, would you agree that homophily is natural? Sort of like
Hang
we
on,
were talking...
Can you explain that term, please? Homophily?
Who wants to explain that?
So we did speak about this earlier. So homophily is when people associate with those who are like themselves. So for example, Cameron, you're my mate, right?
Yeah.
Is it wrong for me to flick you an email, let's say, when some new work opportunity comes across my desk, rather than the alternative of sending that email to 1,000 different strangers, one or two of whom might actually be a better fit for that opportunity than you are? So is there a trade-off between this efficiency of using your existing network to drive business, because that's going to be lower cost on the one hand, and comprehensive access and inclusion of everybody and all opportunities being available to everyone, which is kind of more in line with traditional democratic principles?
Yeah, there is a bit of a trade-off. And you're right, this idea of homophily, that people sort of self-organise into like-minded groups, is very natural. What we really want to do is get people to think of the whole country as their group.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than me and my mates from my private school,
right.
For example, who
right.
happen to, you know, be in all key positions of power. And we want people to act in the interest of the broader group. But it is very natural. And you're right about what you spoke about earlier, about the formation of class. This is exactly how it happens over time. So I'm going to just agree with you. What was your question again in particular before we got sidetracked by the definition?
I'm just wondering, where is the Goldilocks point? So, you know, we have efficient production by using people we know. Right? We just all know it's more efficient. I always hire my honor students as my research assistants, for example. I don't do, you know, public calls to all undergraduates who might like to be my research assistant because it's just easier. I know them and whatever. Now, should I feel bad about that? Is that a norm that I should, you know, be thinking, oh, Gigi, no. Think about the broader university, the broader, you know, population of students who need to be developed.
Yeah, well, maybe you should. Depends. Okay, so I wouldn't propose, for example, that everybody's mum and dad takeaway store go and have elaborate hiring processes to make sure it's very fair to hire their new waiters and kitchen hands.
Mm.
Okay, I would be happy for them to hire their kids or their kids' mates or whoever to work in their restaurant. Because as a society, we've agreed that it's their money that they're putting on the line for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my rule of thumb is, if it's your money you're putting on the line, okay, and in the broader picture, that's what you've earned and that's your right to do it, then use your networks if that's more efficient. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes it might not be. Okay, just, you know, sometimes your mates do renege and have other mates that they're more loyal to than you.
Sure.
But if what you're doing is making a decision on behalf of somebody else, like as a politician, you're making large decisions on behalf of the rest of us.
Or you're hiring in the public service.
Or you're hiring in the public,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What you should really be doing is be looking at it in reverse. Look, it's not my money. I have to go in the interest of fairness. And although this might cost a little to run this tender process or whatever it might be, okay, in the end, it's going to be fair. And that has a value itself in the long run. I mean, you can organize these things to reduce the costs, okay? You can have tenders with fairly long-term contracts and then, you know, you redo it every few years rather than every tiny little project.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a balance there you can do. But if you are spending other people's money, you definitely want to be at the other end of doing it in a fair way.
I'm thinking of Sydney, where the New South Wales Liberal government received an unsolicited proposal from Kerry Packer to develop a casino. I'm thinking of Melbourne, where the Labor government received an unsolicited proposal from Transurban to build the Westgate Tunnel. And, you know, I've spoken to the Victorians about this. I said, why did you do that? Why didn't you open it for tender? And they said, well, these people had it all worked out, you know.
Sounds easy. Make it easy, right?
Yeah, that's just an excuse to let your mates control what's happening. I mean, even if you get
that proposal...
They
weren't even their mates. In that case, they were not their mates. In fact, Transurban is associated with the Liberal Party, but Labor accepted their unsolicited proposal.
Yeah, one thing I have learned in my research is this Liberal-Labor divide doesn't really exist when it comes to what's happening behind the scenes and the networks of relationships and the donors. So, for example, 60% of the political donations by value in Australia come from political donors who donate to both sides of politics equally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There is no division. I mean, it's more like theatre out on the front stage. Oh, it's a battle between one party and the other.
Mm.
Behind the scenes, everybody's buddies.
You're listening to The Economists on ABCRN with me, Peter Martin, Dr. Gigi Foster, and Cameron Murray, author of Game of Mates: How Favours Bleed the Nation.
One of the things I actually get really amazed by is how some of our politicians are really open about representing industries or companies rather than people or geographic constituencies. For example, when the resources minister, Matt Canavan, temporarily lost his seat because of the citizenship crisis, he wrote a note on Facebook. Could you read the note, Peter?
Yes, I've got it here. It has been such an honour to represent the Australian mining sector over the past year. It is an industry of fine, hardworking, innovative people. Now, what is that?
It is just amazing. It's so blatant.
But lots of people wouldn't have regarded that as extraordinary because they think, you know, the mining industry, Australia.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the problem. There's a wrapping in the flag that happens. Mm. And we see this again. We've seen it just recently, actually, in the Tasmanian election. So Tasmania, our island state, just recently had an election. And there was an awful lot of finger pointing between both of the big political parties, Labor and the Liberal Party, regarding the connections that were in place between the poker machine industry and the big parties. So Labor had promised to remove pokie machines from Tasmania's pubs. One company, Federal Group, owns all of them, something like 3,500 of them. And massive advertising by Federal Group and others helped defeat Labor. Now, we couldn't actually find a clear statement about what had happened in relation to the money flows here. So we've found that there is one snippet that we've been able to find, which is the current premier accusing the opposition leader, this is before the election, of accepting money from the poker industry. So let's have a listen.
Now, what really interests me is that we learned today that Rebecca White goes into state, takes money under the table from gambling giants then comes back here and pays out on anyone who's involved in the gaming industry here. Now, that shows that you can't trust Labor. You don't know what they stand for. You don't know what you'll get.
How can you talk about taking money under the table when you're not going to tell us how much the gaming lobby's giving you?
Well, we're not the ones who are going around paying out on gambling interests here and
it's
operators
all right if
here.
You take their money as long as you're doing what they say. Is that what you're saying?
We're not being hypocritical. It's Beck White who goes into state, takes money under the table, comes back here, pays out on anyone who's involved or supportive of the gambling industry. They're the hypocrites.
Now, do you notice he doesn't actually answer the reporter's questions? There's this constant game of shifting and finger-pointing, and to me that just highlights how little moral certainty there is about what is actually okay. I mean, what would happen to him if he said, yes, in fact, the Liberal Party has accepted, you know, X dollars from the gaming industry, and if Labour said the same thing, what would people do? How would they react? There's just this vacuum of certainty about it, and so everybody just finger points.
I'll comment on that.
Yeah, please.
Because what's really interesting is that everybody knows they're both accepting money, so it's not a secret.
Yep.
Okay. So their efforts to not answer the question and maintain this facade are absolutely nothing to do with communicating a different piece of information.
Yeah.
So that you listen to that interview, and it's obviously you can't believe a word he says. What it's about is communicating loyalty to those groups. I'm willing to take your money, and I'm willing to defend you in front of everybody else. Okay, we're in this together. So it's really about a coordinating between these groups. That's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could just get up and say, yeah, I took their money and we like poker machines. Okay, and nothing would happen. It wouldn't even be in the media.
Okay, so Cameron, let me just ask you one final question then. Given the dynamics that you've studied here in Australia and what we've talked about today in relation to norms around homophily and giving favors to people in one's network, is there something that the government can do?
We need a crisis to react. And typically we rely on the crisis of losing power in government. And I think the trick to capitalizing on them is to have all these community groups and other interest groups that are much more at the sort of broad level and at the community level talking about the types of change we want, the types of policies that will work, so that when the crisis comes, it's very hard to ignore the thing that everyone's been talking about.
This is deeply depressing, not the least, because it tends to suggest that inequality will get worse.
Yeah, I think it will get worse before it gets better, most certainly. I think it'll get worse until people are on the streets, every week or every month protesting about it.
Our guest has been Dr. Cameron Murray, co-author of the book Game of Mates, How Favours Bleed the Nation. Thanks for joining us, Cameron. It would be great if when you were next on air, you were the bearer of better news.
Thanks for having me. Look, I think I'm young enough to live through this and be on the upswing of the next cycle. It always comes in waves.
Thanks again, Cameron. And that's the program. If you'd like to catch up with some of our previous shows, The Economists are available online. Head to the RN homepage and follow the prompts.
Next week on RN Summer, The Economists, Money and Happiness. Research shows that having money really does make you happier. But are people in rich countries happier than those in poorer ones? We'll ask our guest, Professor Betsy Stevenson, what exactly is the link between economics and happiness? Betsy is Associate Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and a former appointee to U.S. President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors.
Until then, thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Martin.
I'm Gigi Foster. See you in 2019. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.